the questions that might come up. But with that, what do we see as the opportunity? Well, in Colorado, like basically every state in the union, we are seeing very rapid shutdown of old fossil fuel plants. And this has been going on for about the last 10 years, but is accelerating now. In fact, Morgan Stanley's projections just from late last year would indicate that we're going to decline from about 20% today to about 8% by the end of the decade for power from coal-fired power stations. And so it looks like this trend is likely to accelerate. In fact, we're waiting for Xcel to publish their new plan here in Colorado in March to see what some of their plans look like for their remaining coal units. But it would look like we're basically going to wind down the use of coal power in Colorado over the next 10 years. And so with that in mind, you do with any problem you can see coming, we need to plan ahead. And that's essentially what we tried to do in 2019 with the Senate Bill 236, which included a large section on asset securitization. So we wanted to get ready for the impacts that would be created by these retirements, by these closures, try to reduce the impact on workers and the communities that will be affected by those retirements. So that's really the context that Colorado undertook this policy work. If you think about a typical coal plant, what has often happened, especially for the ones built in the 70s and 80s, is that you have the initial construction. So just for round numbers, let's say that's $1 billion of value that gets invested on behalf of the ratepayers of the state. You then depreciate that over time, just like you do with normal IOU financing, investor utility financing. But then along the way, we've had upgrades, pollution controls, efficiency improvements, and each one of those has kind of refreshed the capital value of that particular unit. And what we're seeing in Colorado is that we've got about $1.5 billion roughly for the units owned by Xcel. And so that has been refreshed over time, even with some of the coal units that were built in the 70s and 80s. And so that's kind of the situation that most coal plants are in right now. So there are really two options at that point. You can take stranded assets that are going to be retired, and you can continue to depreciate them just with normal utility financing. And that's what this cash flow diagram on the far left indicates, the utility financing, where you pay off a portion of the capital, but you also have the weighted average cost of capital return, the guaranteed return that the IOU gets. And that's what normal utility financing looks like. Or you can swap that out for a ratepayer-backed bond. And that's essentially what securitization is. It's like refinancing your mortgage. You can keep paying a higher interest rate. The WACC is typically 7%. Or you can change that out for a ratepayer-backed bond, which right now is probably going to get something south of 2.5% on the commercial AAA bond there. Market. So that's kind of the difference, the two choices that we have at this point. And you can see just very graphically which one is better for the ratepayer. It's much cheaper to refinance your mortgage at 2.5% than it is at 7%. And that's really the kind of the basic concept here of securitization. So if you think about the three choices in front of you, you just keep doing what you're doing. That's choice number one. So you keep the current asset, you keep running it. That's going to come in at roughly $50 to $60 per megawatt hour for the customer. Option number two, which some investor-owned utilities have proposed, which is do accelerated depreciation on the asset so they get paid back quicker, but still with the weighted average cost of capital. That comes out to almost $70 per megawatt hour, so much more expensive for the customer and for the ratepayer. Or you use securitization, refinance the mortgage, so to speak, and replace that power with wind, solar, batteries, and other low-cost options that can be evaluated by the commission. And that turns out to be about half the price of continuing to do either Plan A or Plan B. So what are the source of the savings? Well, as I said, it's kind of simple. You're refinancing your mortgage at a much lower interest rate is kind of the easy way to think about it. But if you dig into the details, you typically get savings generated by these categories. You eliminate the utility equity costs because, of course, that's the highest cost thing for the ratepayers. They've got to pay the return on equity for the investor-owned utility on that coal unit that is now going to be retired. And that's typically 10, 11%. In some cases, I'm not sure what it is in Minnesota. In Colorado, it's just shy of 10%. for the equity return. You also reduce interest expense. You get rid of a lot of revenue requirement over the 25 years of the bonds. And very importantly, you don't have to pay a top up to the investor-owned utility to cover the income tax. And so that reduces the required revenue as you do this transaction. So those are kind of the basic categories of the savings as you dig into the details, which of course you'll want your commission to do if you move forward with securitization. So this is my final slide, just to say that roughly for every $100 million of asset value that you use securitization for, it generates about $42 million in immediate savings for the ratepayer. Now, that savings is just from the refinancing. There's also additional savings because you are lowering the marginal cost of power. You are, in some cases, able to replace the portfolio with a smaller amount of generation, depending on your situation. And you're completely eliminating fuel price risk, which the IOU typically passes through to the customer. And so you've gotten that completely off the table. So those are additional savings that the customer will enjoy. And then as the legislature, you can start thinking about, well, how do we want to use all these savings that we've just generated through doing securitization? Well, you can use it for rate reductions, of course, which would be a very appropriate way forward. You can also, though, importantly, use it for retraining affected workers or helping them with transition and retirement packages. And I think I'm sure this is the same in Minnesota. We've got a lot of local bond initiatives, especially with the schools, that are totally dependent on these very large taxpayers in those jurisdictions. So in some cases, these coal plants can be 50% of all of the tax revenue for the property tax side of a county or a municipality. And so that's another possible use from the savings, is that you share that back with the local jurisdiction to help backfill some of that lost property tax revenue and support those local bond issuances. So those are some of the ideas that we're evaluating right now in Colorado. We have turned this math exercise over to the Public Utility Commission. We're gonna ask Excel and the other IOUs to show their math, to show what their plan is for this energy transition, and make sure that it is at least as good as using securitization to lower costs for ratepayers. So that's where we are in Colorado. I will stop there because I definitely want to save a few minutes for questions. But thanks again for having me, and love to help if I can as you guys evaluate this policy option.
Thank you so much, Senator Hansen. So I'll start with the first question, and then if others have questions, please raise your hand in the chat in the participant function below. So Senator Hansen, the first question I have for you is, can you talk a little bit about the coalition that came together in Colorado to support the legislation and what that looked like?
Yeah, thanks, Representative Long. So it was a broad coalition that was heavily involved in this bill. And one of the things that we did right away was make sure we got good input from consumer advocates, consumer groups, especially the large consumers, because I think they are in a position to really benefit from moving forward with securitization. And that was a really big piece of the coalition. As you might expect, we had some of the environmental groups that, of course, wanted to reduce emissions in the state as fast as possible. They were heavily involved in legislation. We had a huge amount of negotiation with the investor-owned utilities themselves to really try to fine-tune and make sure that it was going to be workable for the state. So some long calls with bond lawyers and that type of thing. But I think we really got to a great place with the bill and were able to get bipartisan support in the final vote, as well as get a lot of buy-in from consumer groups in Colorado.
Thank you. I see Representative O'Neill has a question.
No, I do. Thank you, Senator Hansen, for joining us. I just wanted a little bit more global picture for Colorado. Can you tell me how many coal-fired plants that you have located in your state? And also, what was the cost of doing this bill to the taxpayer? If you could just give us a little bit more global information there.
Yeah, sure. Representative, we have, I'm trying to remember the exact number. Mark Dyson might have it for us in a second. I think we've got 10 units that are operational right now. And so that's, it is still a significant piece of Colorado's portfolio as of today. On your question about the cost to taxpayer, if ratepayers are taxpayers, it's actually a huge savings. And as far as does it cost the state government anything, the answer is no. This has no impact on general fund expenditure. It has no impact on the credit of the state because these bonds are backed by the ratepayers directly. So there's no impact on state credit rating or state credit calculation. So from that standpoint, there's really no impact on the state government.
Representative O'Neill, do you have a follow-up? Go ahead.
Thank you. Yeah, this format's a little interesting. So you've got 10 units or 10 facilities, or sometimes, you know, like we've got Sherco, which has three different units. So do you have 10 separate units or 10 separate sites? And do you know what the output is per site? Or, I mean, not per site.
Representative, I'd be very happy to send you that spreadsheet with, absolutely, we have places where there are multiple units. Craig has three units, for example, which is in the northwest corner of Colorado. So I think it's five sites total, but Mark may have this off the top of my head, but I'd be very happy to send you that spreadsheet with all the megawatt capacities per unit and their location, if that would be helpful.
Thank you. It does help sort of put a picture as to what exactly you're talking about converting, and just comparing apples to apples. So we kind of have a sense here in Minnesota how widespread your coal-fired plants are. So they're in five separate locations, but 10 units. That helps put some perspective. And I appreciate what you said about taxpayer and ratepayer. They are the same. I have two very large facilities just inside and just barely outside my district. And so I have hundreds and hundreds of people in my district that work at these facilities. One is nuclear, so that's a happy story. The other one is a coal fire that's being converted. The last question I have is, what is the, if they were just gonna do sort of a natural end of life, how old are these units? You had said there were some were built in the 70s, some in the 80s. So if you, as you're transitioning away, are they kind of coming to their natural end of life and would need to be replaced in any case? We sort of were looking at that with one of our big coal fire plants in Becker, Minnesota, which is the Sherco with three units. So they were, you know, kind of doing the calculations that you were talking about. Do we want to refurbish and extend life, or do we want to just convert? So can you give us sort of that picture too? You had just briefly talked about it, saying that they were built in the 70s and the 80s, but if you could just give us a bit more detail, that would be helpful to compare.
Yeah, Senator Hanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The Colorado portfolio is a mix. There are units that are much older, built in the 70s and 80s. We also have one unit in Pueblo that was built in 2008. So we've got a mix across the portfolio. I would just encourage you not to think about it as like natural end of life. I would think the better way to approach it is, what is the most cost-effective decision we can make today for the ratepayers of the state of Minnesota? Because the investment in the plant is a sunk cost from an accounting standpoint. And so the thing to do now is just say, okay, what is the most cost-effective way to get reliable electricity to our ratepayers? And in almost every case, coal now is not the most cost-effective option, because its marginal cost is $35 to $40 per megawatt hour, at least in Colorado. I'm guessing it's similar in Minnesota. And we can now get options that are lower emission and much lower cost. And so I'm not sure kind of natural end of life, I'm not sure it's relevant. We want to, I think instead, I'd encourage you to think about it as a net present value calculation for the ratepayer, because the initial investment in the plant, in a sense, is a sunk cost. So now we just need to think about, how do we deal with the stranded asset situation that's still on the utilities books.
Senator Osmak has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Hanson, we can actually retire everything in the state of Colorado effective immediately. In other words, shut off everything that would be under consideration for shutdown under your scenario. What would be the net impact of carbon into the atmosphere on an annual basis? And how much would that actually, what percentage of carbon reduction would that actually be reflected in the global output of carbon that goes in the atmosphere on an annual basis in the entire planet?
Well, I'd be happy to get you the specific, megatons and million ton figures for Colorado. The coal plants in the state right now contribute significantly to the state's emissions. And we have set a very assertive goal to reduce carbon and greenhouse gas emissions in the state of Colorado by 90% by 2050. And I'm imagining we're probably going to try to move faster than that. And so that, I think, is the retirement of the non-economic coal plants, which is essentially all the coal plants in the fleet here. This is an economic decision. I mean, I think we can have a great conversation about climate change and carbon emissions, and we have set specific goals in Colorado, and I'll leave that to Minnesota to decide that on your side. But this is fundamentally a way to save ratepayers' money. And I just want to emphasize that. I'm not making a climate change argument today. I'm happy to do that. But today was really about why this is such a good deal for ratepayers. To your last question, the global emissions, I would say that's not really relevant for state policymaking here. We need to show global leadership. The Chinese right now are showing global leadership by setting specific goals. We need to decarbonize our economy as fast as we can, or we're going to see environmental damage really beyond our comprehension. So that's what we're trying to do in Colorado.
So, Mr. Chair, just to follow up.
Yep.
So, Senator Hansen, so you are, what you're saying is this is your testimony is purely based on the economics and has absolutely nothing to do with carbon in the atmosphere, nor do any of these calculations you're providing to us in your testimony have any influence of carbon into the atmosphere. This is purely based on dollars and cents within the state of Colorado or in the state of Minnesota. Is that what your testimony is saying?
That's exactly right. I mean, look, there are significant environmental benefits from shutting down coal plants. We all know that. It benefits in local particulates and NOx and SOx and CO2. We know that's true, but that's not what I'm here today to share with you. What I wanted to talk about today, what I tried to talk about today, was the economic case for why I think it would make sense for Minnesota to use securitization, because I think you can save your ratepayers significant amounts of money.
Senator Hansen, do you have time for one more question?
Yeah, that's fine, Jimmy.
So I just had one quick follow-up. Could you talk a little bit about how your law is envisioning working with the communities that are having coal plants potentially transition and what funding is made available by using this tool?
Yeah, I really appreciate that question. I think that's a really key piece of this. And I think, I put up the map here of all the states that have some form of securitization. We had, four states that passed laws just recently, including Colorado and our neighbor to the south. And then I put kind of red dots on states that are actively having this conversation. The really important piece of the tie-in of what we did in Colorado to the transition assistance, I think, is something that might be useful in Minnesota. This is an issue that requires significant and dedicated funding. And our state budget, the general fund, was not in a position to put tens of millions of dollars in this direction. And so I was really trying to think creatively about how to use the retirement transaction, the securitization transaction, to help fund the assistance, the transition assistance for the communities and for the workers. And so we have put into our bill the ability for the PUC to put that into the financing order and to generate several million dollars, tens of millions of dollars per transaction that would go directly to help the workers and help the towns. And we'll let the PUC kind of figure out the right level there. They're going to balance that out of how much of the savings should go to the ratepayers directly and how much should be reserved to help with the transition. But it's approximately 15% of the savings, I think, is about the right amount. And therefore, the customer gets about 85% of that savings. And we think that's a balanced approach for Colorado and helps us solve an issue that has been ignored for way too long. And so we created a just transition office within the state government, and that office's work will be funded in part by these bonds used during securitization.
Thank you so much. So I know you have to run. So I appreciate you being here with us today, and good luck with your budget conversations.
All right. Thanks, everyone. Great to be with you.
Thank you. So we have a quorum now. So if Senator Osmak, would you care to move the minutes from the last meeting?
So moved.
Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor of approving the minutes, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? Okay, our minutes are approved. So thank you for the indulgence for letting Senator Hansen go first. As I mentioned at the beginning, he had to head out to a budget meeting. I also just wanted to mention that we received two letters for written testimony that have been posted to the website, if members would care to take a look at those. And for those who weren't with us at the beginning, mentioned that also the request for reimbursement forms are on the website. So with that, we're going to take our next three testifiers together as a group, and then we'll ask questions for the testifiers at the end. And our first of those three testifiers is Mark Dyson. He is a principal with the electricity practice at the Rocky Mountain Institute. Mark's actually a Minnesota native and shares my alma mater of Carleton College. He has a master's from UC Berkeley in the Energy and Resources Group. And Mark, welcome to the committee.
Thanks very much, Representative Long. Can folks see my screen here?
Yes, we can.
Great. I'd like to speak with you all today. Thank you for having me. I'd like to speak with you all today around what we see happening in the market, focused on electricity in the United States, what that means in terms of what to expect for a state like Minnesota, and some of the risks and opportunities to mitigate those risks that we've been exploring with partners in our work across the country. For those of you who aren't familiar with Rocky Mountain Institute, we are a nonprofit, nonpartisan research and consulting firm. We're based in Colorado, but have offices around the country and around the globe. We focus on what we term market-based solutions to clean energy. So we are not a traditional environmental advocacy group. Rather, we often work directly with utilities, directly with policymakers, commissions, non-utility businesses to find opportunities to address both economics and environmental risks at the same time. It's wonderful to be here with you all today. I lead work in RMI's electricity practice, focused mostly on the United States, but increasingly globally. And as Representative Long mentioned, I'm a native of Goodhue County, and so it's great to be able to share some of my work with this group today. I'd like to cover three main messages in my remarks today. First, I'd like to share with you all our view of what's happening. What are the trends in the market that we believe will dictate the evolution of the electricity sector and the broader energy landscape in this decade? From there, I'll move into what opportunities that unlocks from the policy perspective, as well as from a utility investment perspective and what we're seeing crop up across the country. And finally, I'll talk about some of the risks that if we don't acknowledge and embrace these trends might be present and imposed upon consumers and ratepayers of electric utilities, and also some ways to address those risks that we're seeing around the country. So I'll move first into just a brief summary of the trends that we're seeing. And of course, the most important trend that I'd like to anchor everyone on today is the remarkable and continuing fall in price of clean energy resources, specifically utility scale wind projects, utility scale solar projects, and battery energy storage. This chart is from the Department of Energy's annual technology baseline that is released every year. And what we see here for wind and solar is the levelized cost of energy in dollars per megawatt hour, falling between 2010 and 2020 by between 70 and 90%. And I'll note here that these are the unsubsidized costs. So these are exclusive of any impact of the federal investment tax credit or the federal production tax credit. And then for batteries, a similar trend, but with slightly different units in terms of battery pack capacity. And then I'll note here the projections going out from 2020 to 2035, where these cost declines are forecast to continue at least through the next 10 or 15 years. And the final remark here, although it's not shown on the graphs, is that everybody who has ever made a prediction about the pace of cost reductions for wind and solar and batteries has been wrong, and they've always been wrong in the same direction. They've always forecast that these prices will stay higher than they actually get. In other words, the industry keeps surprising us in terms of how much cost they are able to wring out of projects as they get as the industry gets better and grows bigger and scales deployment across the country and increasingly across the world. So prices are falling. What does that mean? As Senator Hansen just shared with us, that means that existing coal plants and new natural gas plants are now more expensive to continue running than it is to, or in the case of natural gas, to build, than it is to build new clean energy resources. So this chart is from an investment bank called Lazard, based out of New York. Lazard every year publishes what's known as their levelized cost of energy study. And this is the most recent version that just came out last month. And what I've circled here in green is the levelized cost of energy of unsubsidized solar PV costs for utility scale projects and wind costs. So ranging, round numbers from the 20s to, at the high end, the 50s for wind, and from the 30s to the 40s for solar. And I'd like to compare that with the marginal cost of running an average existing coal-fired power plant, which is circled in down below in the red, about $40 per megawatt hour, and the levelized cost of building a new gas combined cycle power plant, which is shown at about $28 per megawatt hour. So these clean energy resources, because of the remarkable cost declines in the last 10 years, now undercut the prices from incumbent fossil fuel assets. And it's not just the energy cost that matters here. Of course, it's not just sufficient to run a reliable electricity system by providing cheap electricity when the sun shines or when the wind blows. We all know that it's important to be able to provide that capacity at peak, that capacity when the wind isn't blowing so hard and the sun isn't shining so hard. And so what I'm showing you here is a concept and actually what we've seen proved out in the market, and I'll talk with you a little bit about that at the end of this presentation, of how different low-cost clean energy resources can actually provide all of the same reliability services as, in this case, I'm showing you the example as a gas-fired power plant. So just to give a high level of what I'm showing you here, and then I'm happy to follow up offline or in questions, or you can look at the citation here. Each of these columns corresponds to one of the grid services that a fossil fuel power plant might provide. So from left to right, energy every year or energy within a given month. In the middle, peak capacity during peak demand periods. And at the right, the ability to ramp or flex the output of a generator in order to meet changes in load or changes in renewable generation. And then the bar charts show what each of these clean energy resources can contribute to meeting the level shown in the red that could be met by a gas-fired power plant. So what we did here is optimized a combination of utility scale wind, utility scale solar, battery energy projects, targeted demand side management, including energy efficiency programs and demand response or demand flexibility programs. And what we've done and what many utilities have done when they look at this is understand how this combination of different clean energy resources, if optimized in the right way and deployed in a way that can support reliability, can actually provide all these same reliability services as a gas-fired power plant, and often at lower cost. And the last slide I'll share in this section is what I'll refer to as, don't take my word for it. The trends I'm covering here are broadly recognized by the financial community, broadly recognized by global investors, and increasingly investors in the United States. So this headline I'm sharing with you now refers to or covers a report that was released by the International Energy Agency just last week, claiming that renewables are immune to COVID-19 and in fact are poised to make up 90% of investment in the global power system this year, and have shown much more robustness against the shocks of the pandemic than fossil fuel resources have. And so really this if this is how the decade is starting in 2020, it's exciting to think about where it could go. So that's where I'd like to turn to now. We know where we're poised at the start of the 2020s, and what does that mean in terms of options for policymakers and utilities considering investments in the power system going forward? And of course, what we've seen in the past few years, especially since 2018, is the proliferation of 100% clean energy, 100% carbon-free energy, 100% renewable energy, depending on where you are, often by 2050. And these goals are being set by policymakers, by utilities themselves. Xcel, of course, was among the first in 2018 with their 100% carbon-free energy by 2050 commitment. And the map here shows the extent of those targets at the state level and at the utility level. And they're fairly widespread and cover a pretty broad swath and a pretty high percentage of the electricity sold in the United States. But ever since, you know, the first utilities and policymakers started talking about 100% by 2050, there have always been questions raised by utilities, technical experts around what it would really cost to get the last 10% or the last 20% of carbon-free electricity on the grid. It's not clear that there isn't necessarily a consensus on what exactly the technology mix is and what the cost implications are of meeting these very ambitious 100% targets. And so what I'd like to focus on is not this 100% by 2050 target, but rather a much more immediate and near-term plan that we think is justified by the cost declines that we've seen just in the last few years and that are forecast to continue into the 2020s, and what that unlocks in terms of near-term targets. So the idea I'd like to pose and discuss is that 90% by 2035 is the new 100 by 50. And I'd like to focus first on the feasibility and reliability argument here. And I'm drawing heavily from a study that was released by a team of researchers at UC Berkeley and at an organization called GridLab that used production grade grid modeling software. So they used the same grid modeling software as utilities around the world to simulate a power system that ran on 90% carbon-free electricity in 2035. And what they found was, as is indicated on the slide here, that new wind and solar projects dominated production, current hydroelectric and nuclear power stations stayed online to continue to provide carbon-free electricity reliably to the grid, and that retiring old legacy coal plants who were no longer economic and reducing the generation from existing gas-fired power plants in order to better balance renewables could both lead to lower costs and serve the reliability needs of this system. So what does this cost? So the charts here show on the left the average wholesale cost of energy if you account for environmental externalities, including, as Senator Hanchin mentioned, the health effects of particulates, for example, that you could avoid by retiring old coal-fired power plants and running gas-fired generators at lower capacity factors. And at the when those externalities are counted, those health benefits are counted, running a 90% carbon-free electricity grid actually costs much less than running a business as usual grid and much less than we pay today for wholesale electricity costs. But of course, given that that's not always possible to account for those externalities, the chart on the right shows what just the base cost of such a 90% carbon-free power system would be without any accounting for health benefits. And what we see is it's a little bit more expensive than a business as usual trajectory, but it's less than we pay today. And again, the reason is because we have all these legacy and relatively high cost power plants on the system today. Shutting them down actually presents a near-term cost savings opportunity for consumers, even in the absence of any environmental regulation that would impose externality costs on those decisions. So that's our view, or one view, I should say, of what this current era of innovation in clean energy is unlocking from a policy and planning perspective. I'd like to turn now to what are the risks of ignoring this, and what are the opportunities that we see to mitigate those risks and proceed with eyes wide open into the coming decade. The first kind of fact I'll draw folks' eyes to is that in competitive power markets, where investors in power plants make investment decisions based solely on expected returns and risk, and do not account for any climate policy and are not guaranteed cost recovery from generation investments like they are in regulated states like Minnesota and where I'm from in Colorado. In these very competitive markets, and I'll highlight two here, one in Texas, one in the Northeast called PJM, investors are already abandoning gas plants and putting all of their investment priorities into clean energy. So the chart here, and I'll walk you through it, on the far left shows the capacity of different kinds of resources that was present in the interconnection queues. So lined up for installation and operation in each of these markets as of 2018. So there are about 74 gigawatts of gas plants in the interconnection queues in Texas and the Northeast in 2018, and about 100 gigawatts of wind, solar, and batteries. Since that year, in the last 2 years, there have been about 17 gigawatts of gas built and about 11 gigawatts of clean energy built in each of those markets. But the real story is what's happened to the rest of the interconnection queue. For gas, over half of the remaining capacity in the interconnection queue since 2018 has been canceled. Investors have pulled back and canceled plans for investing in new gas-fired power plants again, because they see the risks. And in looking at the other side of this chart, the queue for investment in new renewables has more than doubled. So investors are pulling back on plans for new gas-fired power plants, recognizing the trends in the market, and piling onto renewable projects instead. And again, this is in the absence of any climate policy. This is in the absence of any regulated cost recovery in these two very competitive markets. This is the action of private investors doing their own calculus on risk and return. And this is one way to look at why they're doing that. So what I'm showing you here is the result of an RMI study that we published last year and updated recently with new cost data, the latest cost data on renewables, natural gas, and batteries. And the blue line here shows what is the cost per megawatt hour, fully baked cost per megawatt hour, including all the reliability services, to build a clean energy resources that could provide equivalent reliability to a new gas-fired power plant. And so back in 2010, that clean energy portfolio cost about $180 per megawatt hour, much, much higher than a new gas plant would have been to build in that year. But because of the remarkable cost declines in wind and solar and batteries since that year, we arrived in 2019 or so at a tipping point where now it's actually cheaper to build a new clean energy portfolio that can provide all the services as a gas plant. It's cheaper to do that than build a gas plant. And that's the solid orange line that says build and operate new gas. Within the next 10 years, we're going to arrive at another tipping point. And that tipping point is where it's cheaper to build a new clean energy portfolio that can provide all the reliability services of a gas plant. It's cheaper to do that than continue to operate a new, an existing gas-fired power plant. In other words, the levelized cost, the fully burdened cost of building new clean energy will start to fall below the going forward marginal costs of running an existing gas-fired power plant. This has already happened for coal. This is some of the rationale we see for securitization, for example, that Senator Hansen talked about across the country, where utilities and policymakers realize they can save ratepayers money by retiring coal and replacing with a combination of gas and renewables. Now we see the same thing happening for gas within about the next 10 years. And because of the continuing cost declines in wind, solar, and storage, we see that tipping point getting closer and closer and closer every year we update the data. So what does that mean? That means that if a monopoly utility invests in a new gas-fired power plant today, within the next 10 or 15 years, they could be in a position of finding themselves, they could find themselves in a position where it's cheaper to, you know, go buy new renewables and batteries than it is to continue operating that gas-fired power plant. And that could impose significant stranded cost risks on the consumers of that utility. And so one way that we've seen states around the country and utilities around the country address that risk that they recognize, that they're investing today in costs that will become stranded in 15 years, is through what we're calling, through what I'll talk about as competitive all-source procurement. So the map here shows for every state in the country, the status of either legislation or Public Utility Commission rules that require that vertically integrated monopoly utilities hold a competitive solicitation process to determine what the least cost resource for new investment would be. In some ways, this mimics the competition that is so great about wholesale restructured electricity markets in the United States, such as those in Texas and the Northeast, by imposing that same rigor of competition and transparency on what has traditionally been a monopoly and somewhat opaque investment decision within non-restructured states. And so a number of states, including Colorado, I'll say proudly, require some form of competitive solicitation. I've highlighted here Minnesota, which is among the many states which there is a requirement to demonstrate alternative options prior to resource procurement, but there's no strong requirement to do a competitive solicitation to define what the space of least cost options looks like at the start. And this is my last slide. I just want to highlight what happens when utilities in these states that require competitive solicitation, what happens when they go to the market and ask, what's the cheapest thing that you private developers can bring me utility to meet the needs of my customers? Utilities that do this find almost exclusively in the last few years that the market can deliver cheaper clean energy than gas plants, right? So each of these circles represents the results of a recent procurement that's been organized in a state that has some sort of competitive solicitation process. And in almost all cases, with a few exceptions, these utilities have found that it is not least cost to build a new gas plant. That they have found that when they ask the market, what is the least cost bids for wind, solar, and storage that you can provide me, the market comes back and says, well, it's wind, solar, and storage, and that beats the gas plant almost in all cases. And so that's where I'd like to leave you as kind of a promising option for harnessing the trends that we see in the 2020s and avoiding the risks of ignoring them. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Dyson. So we're going to hear from our other two testifiers, and then I think there will be plenty of time for questions, and I see we've got a good list started. So we are going to go next to Julie Pierce. Julie is the Vice President of Strategy and Planning for Minnesota Power and has a degree in electrical engineering from North Dakota State. So thank you so much, Julie. Take it away.
All right. Thank you. Good morning, and thank you, Chair Long, members of the committee, for allowing me to join you today. My name is Julie Pierce, Vice President of Strategy and Planning for Minnesota Power. I'm here today with my colleague, Jeff Sissons, who is our Assistant Treasurer, to review Minnesota Power's clean energy and carbon reduction journey, along with our investigation into securitization, which is just getting underway as a potential rate mitigation tool for our customers. So as we have all been experiencing in real time, Minnesota utilities have had a very thoughtful transition of our coal-fired facilities to date in this state. We continue to balance and provide customer rate and planning tools through our statutes that help Minnesota be a leader in the clean energy transformation currently underway in the nation. A very exciting place to be. Minnesota Power itself, we've moved really quickly, as the charts show here, and efficiently to reduce our carbon and add renewable energy through our energy forward strategy, while we keep our reliability and affordability for our customers at the forefront. This year, amidst everything that's happening, we are achieving a very significant energy milestone. We are providing 50% renewable energy mix and a 50% carbon reduction to our customers from 2005 levels. And that means that just this year, over 500 megawatts of new renewable energy came online this year. And I can't say how proud I am of our utilities and our workforce to be able to get all this done in such a traumatic year. So we are delivering right now more renewable energy to our customers than any other utility. And we're really number two in the overall Midwest. We've been busy, as you've heard from us before. We've retired or remissioned 7 of our 9 coal plants in the state. Very thoughtfully helping move those coal plants to either retirement or remission states, and helping our customers achieve their own renewable and carbon reduction targets through our new programs and options that we've brought forward through the Public Utilities Commission. On top of this, Minnesota Power has the second largest customer demand response program in the market footprint for MISO. We provide more customer demand response that's available from our customers through unique programs. We also have a year-over-year state leading conservation program, and we've surpassed all of our state policy goals for over a decade. And we've been working closely with stakeholders to manage this clean energy transition. It's been a lot of hard work. It hasn't been easy, but we've really been getting it done here in the state of Minnesota. We've been delivering real carbon reduction and these real energy advancements right now. To date, we've taken over 3 million tons of carbon out of circulation on an annual basis, but we have no intention of stopping there. We are committed to a sustainable future of reliable, cost-competitive, and increasingly lower carbon energy. As many of the presenters before us talked about, this journey is full force and happening. So as we prepare for our next phase, if you want to go to the next slide, we're going to be filing an integrated resource plan and baseload study next year. This filing will include scenarios for the thoughtful transition of our last two coal baseload generating units at the Boswell facility in Cohasset, Minnesota, right there located on the map. And we're going to recognize and look at options for early retirement of these facilities at the same time we look at reliability and affordability. As you can see from the map, retiring baseload generation can be a very intricate, complex equation. The facility in Cohasset, Minnesota is the largest in northern Minnesota and provides critical support to the electric grid in Minnesota and beyond our borders. It's the only electric baseload electric generator in that whole upper part of our state and that surrounding region, reaching into Wisconsin as well as North Dakota. It's a vital facility and economic component of Cohasset and the surrounding communities in Itasca County. This, as you can see shaded in, is we serve up in our neck of the woods, a very rural part of Minnesota, the largest industries in the state, with some of our customers' demand equaling individually twice the entire city of Duluth for context. And then we've been experiencing quite a bit of volatility, which really comes into play as you think about the broader implications of transformation. This year alone, due to the pandemic and the recession, we've lost over 40% of our customers for a period of time. And two of our customers announced they were going to be indefinitely idling their facilities, creating a whole new dynamic. Losing those two customers alone this year was the equivalence of our whole residential customer class. Very impactful as you think about how to manage transformation and transition. We're very fortunate now that we're going to look at one of those customers signaling coming back, but we do have that ongoing uncertainty in our portfolio and how they're going to operate over the long term. This cyclicality and business cycle is really important and impacts Northern Minnesota is in a disproportionate way to others as we look across the United States overall. And this is something that we must plan for on an ongoing basis and incorporate into all of our transformation. As we look at our transformation going further in our last large baseload generating units and thinking about that doing ahead of schedule, their customer cost is a key consideration. We recognize we serve customers both big and small that are price sensitive, particularly in this current environment, from large industrial users to the lower income challenged residential customers. We need to protect against unreasonable customer rate increases that will pressure the economic balance here and keep reliable service, reasonable cost, healthy industry and communities, and really valuing our longstanding value of sustainability. So this is a delicate balance as we look at this, and our Boswell equation is a very interesting one as we look ahead. If you want to move to the next slide, as we continue to move forward, we're going to be considering all economic and financial tools that are available to us, including securitization. And as you know, utilities regularly bring forward a variety of rate mitigation tools on an ongoing basis. Some are more complex, some are short-term, some are long-term, and their impacts, both short and long, need to be taken into account. Most recently this year, hopefully you've heard and felt how we've, in Minnesota, the utilities resoundingly responded to the pandemic with our innovative and swift options to help our customers bridge this difficult time. using mitigation tools like rate case settlements, deferred accounting to support our customers and our communications during this challenging time. So we have been analyzing securitization for a bit of time here, but we've recently been very excited to partner with Rocky Mountain Institute to really benefit from their expertise and understanding and really looking into the key considerations about securitization and looking at challenges and opportunities. We've been asked by the Public Utilities Commission to bring forward two reports here. We just filed in October a phase one report with some initial findings, and we'll be bringing forward a phase two report in early next year with the rest of our integrated resource plan that will look at additional cost evaluations of this tool in our own transformation. So let's talk a little bit about the tool. You know, and like any rate mitigation tool we have in Minnesota, it's likely not a one size fits all. We always feel that tools are most successful if they're versatile, adaptive, you know, more like a Swiss Army tool versus a rigid wrench, right, with not a lot of flexibility. Because in Minnesota, we know too well that no two utilities are alike. And this is complex, high consequence type rate mitigation that should really be considered by the utility how it best fits with their profile and how the utility can consider it. So as we look at, you know, we already talked a little bit about the opportunities that were on the table. We wanna talk about some of these initial challenges and gating items that we're finding and trying to find ways to work through. Obviously, the securitization needs to make sense from a cost-benefit standpoint. It needs to be the right financial tool, and obviously every financial tool has some costs. Probably most predominantly for us, as I mentioned, our volatility in our load and how that impacts our rate making is really something we're looking into. You know, these bonds that securitization provides are their must pay obligations, and they don't have the same flexibility that we currently have with rate making with the Public Utilities Commission. Public Utilities Commission can phase in, they can adapt and morph year to year rates and how they're used. This securitization tool we're finding is it's more rigid. It's a must pay bond that has to be paid each year no matter what your customer level is doing. So for an example, so in 2008, 2014, and this year, where Minnesota Power lost large volumes of its customers, like in this example, 40% this year, for long periods of time, we would have to immediately adapt our securitization surcharge or what we charge our customers to true up that bond revenue so that they could be made whole. So you can imagine this could create a lot of rate volatility for our customers. And that is not always welcome, especially during pandemics and recessions, if we were to have to automatically shift our rates by a dramatic amount for our customers. So how do you mitigate that? I think we need to look into a number of things. However, we got to be careful that the mitigation isn't more complex than the original tool. And then compare those tools together with other tools we have available for rate mitigation in this big transformation that's underway. So again, I'll stop for questions here. Our next steps are to evaluate further securitization and how it fits into our transformation, compare it with other tools, and then incorporate this study here for the commission at the start of next year. We're very excited to be working with RMI and partnering with our other stakeholders. But we recognize we have many factors to consider when we're working towards and managing our transition here for the Boswell facility. Cost, community, grid, environment, all of it has to come together in a balance and help us with the pace of this next piece of transformation. But we're really excited to get after it and look forward to your questions. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Ms. Pierce. Our final testifier, and then we'll take questions, is John Brecky with Great River Energy. John is the Vice President and Chief Power Supply Officer. And John, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Hang on, my share screen button just went away. Here we go. All right, good morning, everyone. My name is John Brecky. I'm with Great River Energy. We're pleased to be here as part of this conversation today alongside Rocky Mountain Institute and our friends from Minnesota Power. You'll hear a lot of messages from us today that touch on the same topics that you've already heard from both of the previous presenters, and I'll tie in some of our thinking on those issues as well. Great River Energy serves 28 member distribution cooperatives in the state of Minnesota. We are a great generation and transmission cooperative. We're owned and operated by these distribution cooperatives that are acting in partnership. The different shades of the colors that you see there for the member systems represent the different contractual arrangements we have with those members. The default arrangement is to provide virtually all of the requirements for the dark blue systems, 20 cooperatives across the state of Minnesota. And the other colors, we provide most of the requirements for the other systems, but virtually all of the requirements for the ones listed in dark blue. 56% of the sales of these distribution cooperatives are to residential customers and 42% to commercial and industrial. So we're very residential in our makeup, and that's a lot of the history of the cooperatives. We've been evolving our portfolio quite rapidly, and Great River Energy in 2018 set a voluntary goal of 50% renewable energy by 2030. That goal remains in place today. We've ramped up the amount of renewables in our portfolio quite dramatically since 2005, 144 megawatts at that time. By 2020, 650 megawatts. We project by 2025, we'll be at 1700 megawatts of renewable energy in our portfolio. And that's for a peak demand system of around 2300 megawatts net of load control. Now we have a very active demand side management system that'll give us about 300 megawatts of capability to provide capacity to the system at peak times. It's one of the top demand side management systems in the country. And Minnesota has a very long history of strong demand side management and conservation efforts. We've just announced a major portfolio transition, and the key components of that transition are summarized on this slide. This portfolio transition was done for economic reasons. We had an economic driver behind this decision, as you'll see in a subsequent slide. But the key components of this is we're going to shut down the Coal Creek Station facility. It's an 1,100 megawatt power plant in North Dakota. We'll be shutting that down by 2023, and it'll be coming out of our portfolio. That's a dual unit coal plant. It's the largest facility in North Dakota currently. We'll be converting the Spiritwood combined heat and power plant from coal to natural gas. Spiritwood today gets its coal from Coal Creek Station. It's shipped over by rail. So when that coal supply goes away, we'll have to switch to natural gas at Spiritwood. We're excited about that switch. We're also going to be looking at biomass as an additional fuel source at Spiritwood going forward. That's a relatively small plant. It has 99 megawatts of peak capacity. To replace the lost megawatts and megawatt hours, the capacity and energy from Coal Creek Station, we've announced plans to add 1,100 megawatts of new wind energy in four states. A lot of it's going to be in Minnesota, but some is in South Dakota, Iowa, and North Dakota as well. We're investing in existing natural gas facilities to increase capacity from those facilities. Today, we have 1,400 megawatts of gas-fired peaking plants spread throughout the state of Minnesota. We wouldn't have been able to make this decision to shut down Coal Creek Station in 2022 had we not had that backbone of peaking dispatchable capacity in Minnesota to maintain reliability of the system. It really is critical to our evolution in our portfolio. It's an essential part of our plan. Almost all of those peaking plants have oil backup that's on site. So for those very cold winter days when natural gas prices spike or natural gas becomes short on supply, in Minnesota, we have oil backup to maintain reliability of the electric grid for our member cooperatives. We'll be increasing our market and market interaction on both energy and capacity. We've long been net sellers of capacity to other utilities. We will become net purchasers with this decision. We'll be buying about 200 megawatts of capacity on bilateral agreements with various counterparties in the upper Midwest. And we expect to be net purchasers of energy in the MISO market as well. Historically, we've been a net seller of energy. And as I said, the key driver of this is the economic best interest of our member cooperatives. But one of the side benefits of this is a carbon risk reduction. We see carbon as a business issue, and we'll be reducing our direct carbon emissions by over 90%, 95% actually, when measured against 2005 emissions in our portfolio. So dramatic carbon risk reduction as a business outcome for Great River Energy with this portfolio transition. I mentioned that economics is driving our decision on the shutdown of Coal Creek Station. This graph shows you the net market position of Coal Creek Station since 2005. So we've got two axes on this chart. On the right, we see the MISO market price. On the left, we see the net market position of Coal Creek Station measured in dollars. This is not including capacity value of the power plant. It's just energy value and the all-in cost of operating the plant. And as you can see, the first 4 or 5 years on this chart, we're doing really well in the market. MISO prices are relatively high. But ever since the Great Recession in 2008, natural gas prices have come down a great deal, and there's been a lot more renewable energy on the grid. Those two things have pressured the MISO market price in a downward direction. And from 2009 to 2014, our net market position of Coal Creek was negative $50 million to negative $100 million. Still a relatively reasonable cost of that capacity when you factor in the fact that it provides 1,100 megawatts of capacity to our members, as well as an energy hedge to them. But the market changed dramatically the last 5 years with more and more renewables, more fracking, a lot more natural gas at low prices. The net market position of Coal Creek has become a burden to our members. And so we've made the decision to evolve the portfolio for economic benefit. A big driver of market price is the natural gas price in the market. And here you see the correlation between the MISO market prices in blue, measured on a per megawatt hour basis, and the natural gas prices in yellow, measured on a BTU basis. So there's a strong correlation there between gas prices and MISO market prices. And that's what helps create this opportunity for GRE to transition our portfolio. But certainly renewables are playing an increasing role in the MISO grid, and that will grow in the future as well. MISO has a changing generation mix. You're all familiar with that, but this graph shows you the new resources that are in the queue waiting for transmission service in the MISO grid. There's 80,000 megawatts of project requests in the MISO queue, and it used to be that wind would dominate those requests. But look at the impact of solar now all across the region, but especially in the eastern parts of MISO on interconnection requests. And in green, you see the wind requests as well. We have concerns about what you're hearing as far as the statements about continued reduction in cost of renewable resources. And one of those concerns is interconnection costs. Those are going up quite dramatically. And we know that the vast majority of this 80,000 megawatts in the queue will not be built. A lot of what isn't built is gonna be for interconnection cost reasons. That tends to drive projects out of the queue, but also there's other factors such as who will be successful in actually getting a deal with the utility under contract for their renewable project. So while we've enjoyed this long period of reduced cost from renewable energy resources, we're not sure that is going to continue along the optimistic trends that you're hearing from some others. And one of the reasons for that is interconnection costs. Those costs are going up quite dramatically. It's the cost of building new transmission facilities to enable the interconnection of all of this renewable energy. We're getting a lot of interest in our storage pilot project, and it's worth mentioning today because as we look at energy evolution, storage is a big part of making it reliable and affordable going forward. So we really have the first of its kind, one megawatt project here in Minnesota. It'll be located in Cambridge. We're very proud of it. It'll be a 150-hour battery. And when we look at the polar vortex of 2019, it was 48 hours where the price, where the temperature in the Twin Cities was 20 below zero or lower. So a 48-hour period. Well, this battery can carry us through with 150 hours of capability, a polar vortex of that size or longer. A four-hour lithium-ion battery does little to provide peace of mind or electric grid reliability in a polar vortex event in Minnesota. This is the kind of battery technology that can actually get us through an event like that. So we're excited to pilot that project, build it in 2023 with our partner, Form Energy out of Massachusetts. Our goal is to show the capability of this technology, to prove the concept, and to be able to scale it up long-term. We'd love to see cost-effective storage become part of the grid in Minnesota and other regions. Think 100 megawatt sizes, 200 megawatt sizes, but we think long duration, ultra low cost storage is gonna be the key. Lithium ion is too expensive, the duration isn't there, and we think we need to be looking at other technologies. So that's the purpose of what we're doing with Form Energy. In the interest of time, I'll skip over this slide because I wanna leave time for questions. But it was just another slide about storage and kind of the benefits and why we're looking at long duration storage instead of 4 hour storage. But it's got to be ultra cheap on a per megawatt hour basis. And it's got to be a lot cheaper than lithium ion for it to really work economically to meet a polar vortex condition. We thought it might help to point out some areas where we think the state can be helpful to utilities in enabling this energy transition and doing it in a way that manages costs and reliability for our member consumers, as well as ratepayers across the state, setting an example for other states as well. We think that we should recognize the importance of peaking generation for reliability. We wouldn't have the opportunity that we've had to make the decision to shut down our largest power plant if we didn't have this strong fleet of reliability sources here in Minnesota. These plants are called on at very crucial times on the electric power grid, and they're something that we need for reliability and to manage costs. So we need to recognize that. They are a tiny fraction of CO2 emissions for the state, but the reliability and cost benefits they provide are quite large. Second, we want to work with the state to encourage wind and solar development. We really do benefit from the permitting support we see from the state of Minnesota. Getting that done in a timely manner to take advantage of production tax credits is really important to the economic conditions that our member cooperatives face. It's also an important economic development opportunity for the state of Minnesota. We want to understand the importance of the wholesale energy market in making decisions like the one that we have made. The wholesale energy market is a virtual battery that's available to us today, right now, without us making the capital investment. So before the Form Energy battery is available to us in a 300 megawatt size, we already have the market available to us today to be that virtual battery. Now, we can't control the carbon emissions inherent in that market on a multi-state basis. We need to be able to interact with that market to optimize our position so that when we have surplus wind energy in our portfolio, which we will have at times, we need to be able to sell that into that wholesale energy market. When we're deficit on wind energy, we need to be able to buy from that market, and it needs to be free and fair and open. And that free and open access is just vital to this major effort to reduce our CO2 emissions and reduce costs to our members, which was the driver of why we did this. And then finally, recognizing the need to manage cost and reliability. And I have a few points I'd like to make about that. So you've heard about renewable energy costs falling. and the trends in that regard on solar, on wind, and on storage. And we agree that those trends have been very beneficial and pronounced, and they're a reason why we're able to make this transition as well. But we do have concerns about those trends going forward, and I'll mention a few of them. The first concern I already touched on, which is interconnection costs. We're seeing hundreds of millions of dollars for a large wind farm to be interconnected with MISO, both in terms of upgrade costs on the MISO system itself, as well as the neighboring market in Southwest Power Pool. We're seeing increased congestion costs from the wind farms in our portfolio already, as well as the ones projected to come into our portfolio. Congestion represents the fact that the transmission system is not perfectly capable of moving generation from its source to all the positions throughout the upper Midwest. And so that cost is something that our consumers have to pay. It's the cost difference in the market between locations. And congestion is increasing for wind farms on our system. The PTC and ITC will expire, and that's in the schedule already. So we're concerned about the cost pressure that will put on future renewable projects. And finally, there are market effects of new renewables that aren't really in the models that you see about the cost of renewables versus other sources. One example of this is the correlation of wind output. It's an inverse correlation between wind output and low market prices in the market. So while we're getting a lot of energy from wind when it's windy outside, the value of that energy in the market is suppressed because of all the wind that's in the market. And the economic effect of that creates an opportunity cost for our membership. And it's just something to be aware of as far as these are concerns we have. Now, we know renewables are a great choice for us, and I've showed you that we've made the decision to move in this direction, but it's only fair to point out we have concerns about these trends going forward and whether they can truly be sustained. We especially have a concern that we share with Minnesota Power about the unique needs in northern Minnesota, and we urge the state to be cautious about preserving reliability and cost in northern Minnesota in a particular manner. That is a constrained area as far as getting transmission there, and the cost of renewables in that region itself would be quite high. So in summary, we exist to serve our member owner cooperatives. We're making these resource decisions based upon economics and what is the best interest of our member cooperatives. We keep in mind our triple bottom line, which is environmental stewardship, affordability of energy, and reliability of service to our members. But our portfolio decision was driven by the economic best interest of the member cooperatives that we serve. Mr. Chair, thank you for the time and appreciate the opportunity to present today.
Thank you so much, Mr. Brecky, for your testimony. I just have one quick question and then we'll go to others on the list. My question's for Mr. Brecky. So this is a really perhaps nation-leading steps that you all are taking as a company, and I'm curious what if you know how you compare nationwide to other similar co-ops or utilities. Are you in fact going the fastest or among the fastest, and also the 90% number that we heard as being largely economic from Mr. Dyson, do you have a sense for when you might hit 90% clean energy for Great River Energy?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, for those questions. The transition for Great River Energy is the fastest that we know of in the generation and transmission cooperative world. We were a coal dominant utility. We had 5 coal fired resources in our portfolio as of 2005. And when we get to 2023, we'll be left with 0. We know of other G&Ts around the country that have not relied on coal historically, and so they're becoming more and more renewable leaders as well. And we know a lot of transitions that are happening, but certainly ours is probably the fastest coal to renewables and gas transition that we've seen. But every G&T is unique as well, and we're taking advantage of unique opportunities to add wind in a very wind-rich region as well as a place where there's a MISO market available to us to be that virtual battery. On the question of the 90% reduction in CO2 emissions, we project that in 2023, our CO2 emissions directly from our portfolio will be 95% below what they were in 2005. And that's on a tonnage basis, tons of CO2.
Thank you. Senator Osmak.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple of questions from Mr. Dyke. You had some interesting testimony, which seems to
Just one second, Senator Osmak. Mr. Brecky, would you mind stopping to share your slides so we can see the members?
Yes, I'm sorry about that.
No problem. Senator Osmak.
Mr. Brecky, in your testimony, you included some commentary that 100% by 2050 is may not be possible. Looks like you're saying it's 90% by 2035. Based on current technology, are you saying that 100% by 2050 is an impossibility?
I think you said Mr. Dyson first. Is that correct, Senator Osmak? Is that a question
for
me?
Mr. Dyson.
No, I do not believe that 100% carbon-free electricity is impossible. What I referred to in my testimony were the questions that many utilities have brought up in asking how exactly they might be expected to reach that 100% target, given the range of options and the immaturity of some of the technologies. But there have been many studies and many technology pilot projects that suggest that there is a range of technology solutions that can get us to 100% by 2050, even if they are not exactly specified today. The emphasis on 2035 is we can skip that debate and do what we know to be economic and cost effective and reliable in the next 10 or 15 years, rather than spend time arguing about what might be possible 30 years from now.
Senator Osmak.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Dyson, just in your commentary now, you just indicated to me that based on current technology, 100% by 2050 is not possible. Are you saying that in the future it may be, but under current technology, it is an impossibility?
Mr. Dyson.
No, Senator, I apologize if I'm not being clear. I'll reference a very specific study that just came out a few months ago that lays out a handful, I think about a half dozen, of possibilities to move from 90% carbon-free electricity to 100% carbon-free electricity. And each of those technology pathways is possible. We know how to, for example, electrolyze hydrogen using renewable energy and use that hydrogen gas and burn it in gas turbines to create that last 10% of electricity to move us from 90% to 100%. We know that to be possible. People are doing it today. The question is, can that technology reach cost at scale that would allow that to be cost effective in 2050? Or is it some other technology, such as nuclear power, that's going to come in and fall in cost and be the most cost-effective option to get that last 10%? What I'm saying is, I don't know which technology is going to be cheapest to get us to 100% by 2050, but we have several options and they're all proven today, just at unknown cost at scale.
Senator Osmak, did you have another follow-up?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a different question, but what you're saying is, and I'm not trying to put words in your mouth, these are my words, that 100% by 2050 is not possible under current technology. And I agree with the testifier that hydrogen fuel sources and hydrogen fuel use is, in my opinion, the wave of the future. And now Xcel Energy has even indicated that they are going to be moving in that direction for a pilot project, I believe, at Prairie Island. And I'm very interested in that. One additional question for Mr. Dyson. You indicated in your testimony environmental externalities involved with carbon-based fuels. In your presentation, you indicated that it seems to me that renewables had lower environmental externalities. Does that take into account the inability to recycle solar power panels? Does that take into account mining that can lead to a significant environmental devastation as portrayed by certain environmental groups. Is that those externalities take into account those costs and those factors in your presentation?
Mr. Dyson.
Senator Osmak, I was referring specifically to air pollution and the impacts of air pollution on public health costs writ large at the continent scale. The factors that you're referring to are real, but I believe that they are exaggerated in many of their accounts in the media. And moreover, they are localized and manageable using known technologies and processes around industrial sites that can minimize their environmental impacts.
Senator, Representative.
Yeah, if you don't mind, if this is the last one, we've got about four or five more questioners.
Senator, I was just going to say thank you for in actually providing me a certain level of comfort in the fact that environmental concerns for certain properties or for certain activities is not as significant and is overblown. I really appreciate the frankness of that answer. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Sandell.
Thanks very much, Mr. Chair, and ladies and gentlemen. I have a couple quick questions. I'll try to be brief. First of all, you've talked about great investment in clean energy, and I wonder if those investments are coming from the utilities reserves, or are they borrowing money, or is the investment coming from organizations like insurance companies, banks, or elsewhere? When I've spoken with large companies around Minnesota about job creation, they've told me that there's a disincentive in Minnesota because of taxes and regulations. And I wondered how that affects your business. And what about energy conservation? Will the reduction in demand cause greater prices than your models are predicting?
Representative Sandell, was that for anybody, or was that a specific?
For anybody, yeah. Okay. Thank you.
Who would like to take that? Mr. Brecky.
Mr. Chair, this is John Brecky. If you'd like, in terms of investment and these renewable energy projects, we are going with power purchase agreements, and that's largely driven by the production tax credit, but also the economies of scale that the renewable energy developers can obtain from owning vast fleets of wind across the United States and North America. So the investment's coming from or through the renewable energy developers, and we're simply buying the energy output on a power purchase agreement. And so that's representing the investment.
Ms. Pierce.
I'll just add from a Minnesota Power investor-owned utility perspective, you know, at the highest level, it does have a lot to do with production tax credits in the moment. But in the moment, we are investing along with partners, I think Representative Sandell, as you mentioned, with banks and others to ensure that we get those tax credits to our customers. So we are doing investment in new renewables in that manner, along with PPAs. So we have a combination here for our utility as we advance our renewable transformation. I also just wanted to comment quickly. I think you mentioned something about conservation and whether or not that was having an impact. And I would say absolutely. I think this utilities in Minnesota have excellent conservation programs and incentives and that are really supported by our Public Utilities Commission and state overall. And we've been doing a tremendous amount of that and seeing those demand curves change as our customer behavior change. So it absolutely, we're seeing it and feeling it. And I think our programs in Minnesota are helping.
So we've got about three questioners left, and we're almost at 11:30. Hopefully folks can still stay on, but I understand if members have other commitments and need to hop off, but we'll continue with these last three questioners before we adjourn. Senator Dibble. Senator, I think you need to unmute.
Sorry, got the video going, but not the sound. So Mr. Chair, thank you very much. Mr. Dyson, I jumped in the middle of his presentation, but I did catch the part in which he discussed natural gas plants being less expensive, both in the short term and the long term, than than bringing on renewables. And that, of course, is a big discussion, particularly with respect to Minnesota Power and the plan proposed for Superior, Wisconsin. So I was wondering, Ms. Pierce, if you could respond to that information from Mr. Dyson about the cost that Rocky Mountain Institute is finding in natural gas versus renewables, and how that might be that proposal.
Sure, and forgive me if I understand your question. The costs shown by Mr. Dyson, as Mr. Brecky mentioned, really are part of the equation. And so as we look at adding new renewables to the system, we need to be very cognizant of what it costs to interconnect and plug those resources into the grid. And right now those costs are very high. And so as we look at what's needed to overall support the reliability for our customers in Minnesota that need it, when it has the polar vortex going on, as well as when we get our 100 degree day, it's important that we have resources that can be there all the time, number one. And number two, we need to find the cost effective way to bring those resources on. And so while we're very excited about how renewables continue to come down, we're reaching a grid point where the grid is getting constrained and it's increasing the overall costs. So we need to take all of that into consideration to find a balance here as we keep the lights on in Minnesota. So hopefully that's answered your question. If not, I'm happy to follow up.
Well, I was curious, Mr. Chair, thank you. There's an interconnection cost when you bring on a huge new peaking plant. So I was wondering if, Mr. Dyson, if you could help us understand, is the interconnect costs, does that offset the cost competitiveness, and should we be going with a bunch of natural gas plants because of that, or how do we respond to that argument?
Mr. Dyson.
Thank you, Senator Dibble. I acknowledge, and I've actually talked with the Great River Energy team that works under John Brecky about this exact issue, and we recognize the serious concerns there are with interconnection costs for new renewables projects in the upper Midwest. And those are real and they need to be addressed. And I think some of the processes ongoing at MISO around transmission planning and coordination of interconnection queues will start to ease some of those burdens in the near term. And there may also be a need to invest in new transmission capacity that can serve the region as a whole and lower costs for a broader expansion across the footprint for new renewables projects. Those are certainly important priorities to keep in mind. I will note that this issue is not unique to MISO, although this is maybe where it's most acute for this group certainly. Other regions around the country have grappled with these same issues around interconnection cost and the ability to deliver renewable energy to load, and have found acceptable solutions. The solution that I ended with in my slides around competitive all source procurement, looking at a range of different options and leveling the playing field for different resources to bid into processes that utilities host, has created some very surprising results in terms of what kinds of renewables projects, often coupled with batteries to minimize some of the variability and related interconnection and integration costs, what prices they've been able to bid in at and beat out a new gas plant that the utility might propose otherwise. So there are opportunities to address the issues in MISO. There are also opportunities to use a more competition-oriented resource planning process that can illuminate possibilities that might not otherwise be obvious.
Senator Dibble, is that good on your end, or did you have another question?
I would be curious to know. I mean, we continually hear about reliability and cost. I think, we will continue to talk about the reliability issue of renewables. And I have opinions about that I think kind of fly in the face of what passes as conventional wisdom. The interconnect costs, I think we do have some work to do in rolling up our sleeves and coming up with some creative solutions so that we can avoid. I mean, it's exciting to hear that there's the 80,000 in the queue. I'd love to get all of that interconnected, but if the cost is going to prohibit that, then we need to come up with something creative. Thanks.
Thank you, Senator. And I'll also note that Senator Osmick had a very informative hearing in our last Legislative Energy Commission talking just about these issues and about the challenges around trying to improve our grid. Senator Marty.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And my question for Mr. Dyson, I was impressed by the charts where you're showing when the price of existing natural gas plants may be higher than the ongoing cost of putting in new renewable. My question is, if you're an investor, if you were, Xcel is looking at a gas plant at Sherco, and I'm just curious, what happens that 10 years from now? I mean, are they, when that was being talked about 5 years ago, it looked a lot different than it does now. What's going to be happening to that in the next 2-3 years? Because we don't know the exact price curve, but it strikes me as 10 years from now, that might look a lot different than we think. Is that something that investors are going to be saying, let's go ahead with that? Should we as ratepayers be thinking that's a great idea?
Mr. Dyson.
Thank you, Senator Marty. I think, you know, to put a bit of a market perspective on the answer to what's going to happen if that plant should be built, in 10 years, it's going to run way less than you might imagine it would run if you're considering the investment today. It will transition because the cost of wind and solar are low, and I believe will continue to fall, especially if we address the interconnection queues that Mr. Brecky brought up. They will start to dominate energy production, and natural gas facilities will transition to more of a backup resource that's useful, as we heard from Mr. Brecky, in the polar vortex conditions around the hottest days of the year, but will actually not be necessary to maintain reliability for the majority of the time. So my view and the research that my and other teams have done suggests that across the footprints of all US markets, we currently have enough existing natural gas to serve as that backup capacity without investing in any more. And so investing in a new plant, putting another several hundred megawatts in the ground, I believe an investor should be very careful about the runtime expectations and the cost recovery assumptions that go in, and in the case of a monopoly utility, are baked into rates such that those consumers 10 years from now aren't paying for a plant that runs 30% as much as it was expected to, and therefore paying a higher per unit cost for every unit of energy that comes out of it. And you know, the last remark I'll make here is that as an investor in such a plant, I would want to make sure that I was evaluating that lower utilization expectation in 2030, for example, and really comparing that, because that will lead to a higher levelized cost of energy. That will make that plant's energy more expensive because I'll run it less. I will want to make sure that there aren't other options that I could invest in now, or that I could wait a few years and see if the form energy pilot that Mr. Brecky referred to can start to scale, because those might be actually cost effective against a gas plant that only runs 10% of the time. I hope that addressed your question.
Senator Marty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a real quick follow-up, and that is Mr. Brecky and Ms. Pierce both said they are working with RMI on these issues, and Xcel isn't here today. I don't see him in the crowd anyway, but I hope they are working with you and others who are looking at those things, because I think those are big decisions that have to be made very quickly now.
Thank you, Senator Marty. Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and my question is for Mr. Dyson. I'm not asking you necessarily to be a personal financial planner, but I followed a couple of mutual funds in the last year, exclusively solar fund has returned 140%. Another is exclusively clean energy, which has returned, I think, 110%. And these are your small to mid-sized capitalization companies, but exclusively renewables. Do you see this trend continuing long-term? Is it something that institutional investors, individual investors, may be looking at their investment portfolios should look at as a good long-term investment? Or is this just sort of a blip this year? Those, of course, you're talking about huge increases over the benchmarks in those categories and Standard & Poor's and all of that. So is this, something that you would think is a long-term trend?
Mr. Dyson.
Well, I won't pretend that my advice has any relevance to you know, stock picking, so please don't take it that way. But what I will comment on is the growth of the industry that we see coming. You know, to meet the target of 90% carbon-free electricity by 2035, under kind of a conservative assumption about load growth and electrification of other sectors, will require about a 7x increase in the amount of wind and solar that we have installed in the grid today across the United States. Other studies have looked at this and assumed more electrification and scenarios that are more in line with economy-wide decarbonization consistent with pathways to limit global warming to 1.5 degrees C above pre-industrial levels. Those scenarios, what I would call more climate-aligned scenarios, see an increase of approximately 15x of the existing wind and solar capacity installed in the grid of the United States today. So to the extent that those numbers and kind of that level of, you know, purely market-based momentum transitioning into a climate policy-aware expansion plan, that there is significant growth left in this industry, and it's not going to stop anytime soon.
Representative Hornstein, did you have a follow-up?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate that, Mr. Dyson. It seems to me that that's, you know, consistent with what I've read, and that you know, this is generally, I think, for investors, small and large, something they should look at.
Our last questioner will be Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have some questions for Mr. Dyson. GRE had talked quite a bit about their four major concerns, some of which also was echoed by Minnesota Power. And really, I'm sure all of our IOUs would echo these concerns as we move to more and more intermittent sources of energy on the grid. One was the interconnectivity costs of hundreds of millions per site, which means to Senator Dibble's question about, well, they both need interconnectivity, whether you're adding a new gas plant or not. But the difference is that you've got different sites. So even if you were lucky enough to only have two different sites to interconnect, it's still a double the cost of one site. So it's just very simple math. The second is the congestion issue, which we have not addressed, and I did not hear in the models. And that actually is one of the largest concerns that we should be talking about, which is what MISO, when they were here and when we went to MISO, in fact, and did a tour, that they were very explicit that if we get above 40% intermittent energy sources on the grid can no longer at its current condition handle that capacity, and we will have brownouts and other things happening. That's something that is an incredibly expensive endeavor to try to mitigate the congestion issues and the intermittency issues as we add past 40% renewable onto the grid, which is why they're very concerned about the interconnectivity, because they don't want to add so much intermittent energy sources onto the grid when it cannot, in fact, handle the intermittent issues. So in these models that we're looking at, yes, that is for the power plant, so to speak, in and of itself, but we have externality issues that are incredibly expensive that we are not addressing. So interconnectivity, which is hundreds of millions per site, the congestion costs, which we're going to have to upgrade our grid in order to sustain all of the additional intermittent energy. Also the market effect, which is what GRE had said very explicitly, that the more wind that's on the system, the less you get when you're trying to sell in. And so I know that some people just sort of dump their wind, for lack of a better explanation, because it doesn't, they can't get much return back on it. So there is that market pressure as well. And something that we have not even touched on is the decommissioning of both wind and solar. Right now, solar panels cannot be recycled except for at the bench. And I know several of us on this call went to Idaho to the National Research Center, where they did talk about hydrogen as a storage idea, and they can do that at the bench, but not at scale. They also talked about the fact that you can recycle a solar panel at the bench, but not at scale. So when we start to talk about these externality costs, we have to include the things I just said, but most importantly, the decommissioning of both wind and solar. And we've all seen the pictures and images and know about the older wind turbine blades that have been landfilled because they cannot be recycled. So these are some pretty expensive, pretty large concerns that have not been addressed in full that lead into the cost in total of switching from base load to intermittent sources. And I would ask that if you're going to be doing models to state legislators, that you would include these externality costs when you're talking about making fiscal analysis. And so I don't know if Mr. Dyson has anything to say about that, but I think that if we're going to be making policy decisions, we should have the full and complete picture, both cost and to the environment, as Senator Osmick also pointed out, that we have to mine the material to make the solar panels. And there have been a great outpouring of opposition in this state to doing that sort of mining. And so I think all of these things need to be on the table and discussed, not just the narrow focus of just putting up the power plant, but all these other external costs and concerns.
Mr. Dyson.
Thank you, Representative O'Neill. I would like to offer a few thoughts in response to the four issues you raised, which are all good ones, and I appreciate the questions. On the first, on interconnection, I agree. This is a problem, and it needs to be addressed, and it can be addressed institutionally within MISO in the form of better management and tracking and kind of cost allocation within the interconnection queue that can ease some of the roadblocks. We heard that quote about hundreds of millions per site. I think those are real numbers from today, but I think going forward, they'll be the exception, not the rule, as we get better at planning the grid at a regional scale and better coordinating the additions. So I wouldn't hold up that anecdote from today as a definitive indicator of connection costs in the future. I believe these issues are addressable. On congestion, you mentioned MISO statements that above 40% renewable energy, they would expect to see brownouts. Two thoughts in response to that. The first is that the models that I mentioned that have 90% carbon-free electricity, much of that coming from wind and solar, those are models that are using production grade software, the exact same software that MISO is using, the exact same software that other grid operators around the world are using. And they ran that model for 7 weather years. They captured the polar vortex explicitly and were able to show convincingly, again, using industry grade software, that the system can operate reliably, largely because we have this glut of existing gas capacity that if we just use it less, more as a backup resource. As Mr. Brecky was saying, use the market as a battery. It's entirely possible to integrate a very high level of renewables without any reliability concerns. And then I'll give you, in addition to that kind of model-based answer, an anecdote, which I think is very illustrative here, which is I started my career working in electricity 12 years ago in 2008. I visited the Xcel Energy Control Center in Denver, Colorado, where they operate all of the facilities that they have across the 7 or 8 or 9 states that they operate, including Minnesota. And at that time, Xcel had, you know, a few percentage points of wind and solar on the grid. And an Xcel operator put up a slide for us visiting researchers showing that above about 10 or 20% electricity from wind and solar resources, their grid would start becoming unreliable and start challenging the economics and lead to substantial rate increases for their customers. 12 years ago, 10 or 20% was the limit for Xcel Energy. Xcel Energy in just this year is committing to getting to 55% energy from wind and solar in its Colorado service territory. And they are lowering rates to make that happen compared to keeping their old coal plants online. So my point in sharing that story is that these numbers that grid operators and industry participants hold up as the upper limit of renewable integration, they are a moving target. And as the industry gets better at integrating these low-cost resources, that number keeps inching upwards. And it's quintupled since I started working in this industry a decade ago. The third concern you mentioned was around markets and price suppression effects of renewable energy. This is a factor. I mean, from first principles, you can't argue that the more wind you put on the system, the lower the price is when the wind blows hard. But as a counterpoint, I'd point you to the investment decisions being made by private investors who don't have the luxury of regulated cost recovery, who don't have a climate policy telling them to build wind and solar farms. And they're investing at a factor of about 10x in wind and solar versus gas, as indicated by the interconnection queues. And some of those projects won't get built, but the investment trends are clear. Again, 90% of global investment in power system capacity this year will go to renewables and not fossil fuel resources. The issue you raise is real, but it's longer term than it's commonly portrayed to be. And in the very near term, private investors are indicating where the money is, and we should take a hint from them. The final note you mentioned is around decommissioning costs and recycling. I'll note that modern wind farms can almost entirely be recycled. And solar, I'm not an expert on the recycling potential of solar, but I will note that the studies who have compared on an apples to apples basis, these externality costs of end of life 30 years from now, recycling of solar farms versus the here and now externalities and public health impacts of continuing to run fossil fuels, there are orders of magnitude difference between the public harms associated with each of those, with the fossil fuel combustion being, of course, much worse. So while I recognize that these are issues that should be studied and addressed, I don't believe that they meet the bar of a material concern as it comes to energy policy, in particular compared to the near-term public health harms of fossil fuels. Thank you.
Representative O'Neill, do you have a follow-up before we close?
I think my ask was to include, if we're going to be shown fiscal models of costs for renewables, I think that it is only fair and prudent to actually include all the externality things as well when they are in excess of doing, say, a gas plant or a nuclear. Well, we won't talk nuclear because we're not going to be building any of those anytime soon in Minnesota, but the interconnectivity, the market effect when you've got much wind. I mean, these are real costs. And I think that they need to be factored into the model. That is my ask. And in fact, if we did miraculously build a new nuclear power plant, we would absolutely have to factor in the cost of decommissioning. As you know, that is a massive undertaking to decommission a nuclear power plant. I have one literally 10 miles from my house. Oh no, less than that. I can see it. As soon as I drive a little bit north of here. So the decommissioning should be factored in, and we do not have the ability to recycle solar panels as of right now. We just were, so Senator Osmak took all of us to Idaho, the National Research Center, and the only thing that's being done for solar panels right now is at the bench, and there is no at scale process to recycle or even deal with anything regarding the solar panel. And of course, as you know, it has highly toxic materials inside of it that would pollute the environment if not dealt with properly. So these absolutely are our external costs that need to be considered. And I ask that if we're going to have a conversation, that those costs be factored in. That is my ask. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative O'Neill. That's our last questioner, and I appreciate everybody's indulgence in going a little over the time we had allotted. Thank you so much to Mr. Dyson, to Mr. Brecky, and to Ms. Pierce for your testimony today. It was excellent. Really appreciate your participation. And with that, our meeting of the Legislative Energy Commission is adjourned.